Central Time, I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. You may not know that there are over three dozen Wisconsin servicemen who were listed as missing in action during the Vietnam War. For Memorial Day, we asked Erin Miller to tell us about some of them. She's the author of the forthcoming book, Wisconsin's 37, The Lives of Those Missing in Action in the Vietnam War. Erin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
How did you first come to know about the Wisconsin servicemen who were missing in action in the Vietnam War?
I really didn't know that much about Vietnam itself and about the missing in action servicemen. So it was 2014, I think it was, and it actually kind of started on Facebook. And a family friend of ours posted an article about a young man named Staff Sergeant James Van Bendegom, who had been missing in action in Vietnam and had been found after like 47 years and was buried in Kenosha on Veterans Day in 2014. And that story itself was really gripping. But then the woman who posted it wrote in her post, "My brother Richard is still missing in action in Vietnam." And I'd known that woman for 15 or 16 years, and I didn't know that. And that seemed really significant to me that I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. And so I started looking into it from there. I took his name and I Googled it. And I think in the age of the internet, I just assumed I would be able to find everything that I wanted to know about him. And I found nothing. And I was dumbfounded that I found nothing. And I spent probably 2 hours online searching. And I ended up with a list of 37 men from Wisconsin who were missing in action. And it wasn't a government list. I did find one of those later. It was a veterans list. And I was really struck by that it was just this list of names, mm-hmm. And that they were all missing. I bookmarked it. I didn't want to forget it. But again, it was just a list of names on my computer screen. And so a few months later, I was in a class at the UW-Madison led by Professor John Sharpless, and it was on the history of Wisconsin. And our final paper was just to write anything on Wisconsin's history. And so I went back to that list, and I thought maybe I can find out about one of these guys, and I can write something about him and mm-hmm. just bring some attention to it. And so I started looking online, and I found a lot of online memorials, and I sent off emails, and I sent dozens of these emails just saying, you know, this is what I want to do. If you'd be willing to speak with me, I'd really appreciate it. And I thought maybe one person would write me back. And I heard back from maybe 12 people within a day.
Wow.
And I very quickly realized that I could do it, but it was not an end of the semester paper.
Yeah. So I was really moved that you said you wanted these profiles to be about how they lived, not how they died. But of course, it's how they died that brought them to your attention. So why was that important to you, to focus on them really before the event that includes them in this group of 37?
Mm-hmm. I guess for a number of reasons. One, I think because we do have the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C., and it's a beautiful memorial, and it really pays tribute to all those men who died and the women who died. But it's the same thing as the computer screen. It's just their names. And I really wanted to emphasize that their lives were not defined by the moment that they died. Also, I was reaching out to family members and friends. And, you know, it's very hard to reach out and say, tell me about how your loved one died. You know, people are a lot more receptive and want to talk about how they lived. And that's really what, you know, the essence of these men is.
And I was really struck by how different their lives were. They form an unfortunate group,
yes.
But they are very different people.
Yes, I think you're right. Like you said, they're united by the fact that they all died, but they're so different. And that's kind of the highlight of the book is mm-hmm. that, you know, they're not just these names. They're individuals who lived very different lives.
I also think it was really interesting that in the introduction, you said that you wanted it to be primarily oral histories. But by definition of the project, you couldn't speak to the people themselves. So you said that you sent out some emails, but how did you find, you know, loved ones for all of these 37 men?
Mm-hmm. The research process was intimidating, but also really, really exciting for me. Because when I was doing this, I was actually able to find a lot about how they died in their military service. There are records in the Library of Congress that are declassified. And so a lot of times with them, I knew how they died before I knew how they lived. And so finding out how they lived was really, really exciting for me. And what I ended up doing was there are a lot of online memorials, like virtual walls, and people will post remembrances on there. And a lot of times they'll leave an email address. So I started with those and I would reach out to those people. And those were kind of the easy ones, the ones who wrote me back from there. And from there, I had to get a little bit more creative. I started reaching out to veterans groups. I'd look up the units that they served in, and a lot of them have alumni organizations. Mm-hmm. And so I'd reach out to those. And then from there, I'd start looking at the high schools that they went to, and I'd look at people have alumni groups from those, too. So I'd reach out to the high schools, and I heard back from a number of those and classmates who were willing to contribute to the book. And then through UW, I had access to newspaper archives. And so I started looking up their names in newspaper archives. And sometimes I could find their family members through there. And then I would find them through White Pages and send them a letter and just say, this is what I'm doing, if you'd be willing to write me back.
It's almost like you were doing genealogy
kind
on
of.
These people. Wow. So you talked to family members of these servicemen, but you also were able to talk to people that served alongside them. So you really were getting those first-person oral histories from both sides of their lives.
Yeah. And it was really rewarding doing that. And it was also really interesting because sometimes I was able to share stories with either the family or the servicemen that they hadn't heard before. So that was really nice to be able to give them something 45, 50 years later that they hadn't heard about before because they had these different experiences. Mm-hmm. And in most cases, I tried to get family and servicemen if it was possible. But sometimes I wouldn't find a serviceman or I wouldn't find the family. And so it would be primarily military or family focused. But I tried to have both of those components in there.
We're talking with Erin Miller. She's the author of Wisconsin's 37, The Lives of Those Missing in Action in the Vietnam War. So, Erin, one of the things that I noticed right away was that if I didn't know who you were and how you had come to write this book, I would have thought that you had been studying and writing about military history for a whole career. But you hadn't. This was a first foray for you. So how did you learn so much about the military, just the structure and war terminology, to be able to research and write the book? It's really an incredible accomplishment.
Thank you. It just kind of came with the territory. I remember the first couple of interviews I did, I really didn't know what I was talking about with the terminology. And I remember somebody wrote me back very quickly. I wrote an email and said something. I was looking up these soldiers, and someone wrote me back and said, he's a Marine, just so you know. There's a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And so I never made that mistake again. I talked to a lot of veterans, and eventually I just started hearing similar words. And sometimes I would ask for clarification. Sometimes I would go back and look it up myself. And eventually I just got very familiar with it. And then for the book itself, we had... For each chapter, everybody who was involved with the chapters was read through them, and they would correct things, the terminology and then details as well. And then at the end of it, when it was all done, I sent each branch to unit members from that branch. So I had one or two people read through all the Marine Corps chapters to make sure that the terminology was correct and consistent.
Wow.
And that helped a lot.
And Erin, obviously, this book is about the stories of these men. So let's dig in on some of those individual stories. You started the project because of James Van Bendegem. Who was he?
So James Van Bendegem grew up in Kenosha. He was the second of four children there. And he really came from a military family, and that was a big part of his growing up. His father served in World War II, and he really, really admired his father and wanted to be like his dad. I met with his brother, Mike, and then his sister-in-law, Darlene, as well. And they just had wonderful things to say about him. But I remember one of the first things they told me was, Jim's story is such a sad, long, bizarre, drawn-out story. And it really is, which is... sad in itself, but especially sad considering he was the youngest man that I wrote about. So Jim grew up, like I said, Jim grew up in Kenosha. He was very outdoorsman. He loved school. He loved hanging out with his friends and with his brother, especially. Him and his older brother, Mike, were very close. And then when he was 17 years old, he dropped out of high school and enlisted in the Army. And he trained, he came back home, and then he left for Vietnam on Father's Day in 1967. And when he got to Vietnam, he was assigned to a unit that had to go up to the Ia Drang Valley. There were bomb strikes in the Ia Drang Valley, and his unit was going in to check the aftermath of those bomb strikes. But by 1967, that pattern had been repeated so many times that the North Vietnamese knew that their unit was coming. And so when they got there, they were ambushed, and his unit was essentially wiped out. The family was told that he was missing in action, and they didn't know what happened to him after that. A couple years later, they were shown a photograph and said, your son's a POW. He's a prisoner of war. And they said, oh, I don't think that's Jim. And the government said, no, we think it's Jim. And so the family said, okay, maybe it's Jim. And so then in 1973, when the prisoners were released, they watched that broadcast, and Jim wasn't one of them. So they knew that he was not the person in that photo.
And then what did they learn later about how his life did end?
Yeah, so Jim was wounded on the battlefield in Ia Drang, and he was actually taken to an underground hospital by the North Vietnamese, which is unusual, nobody's really sure why. And he survived for about 2 days. He was very severely wounded. He survived for about 2 days. And there were a few other Americans with him. And one of the last things he told one of the Americans there was, I just want to go home.
And he had only been there for 3 weeks.
He'd been there for 3 weeks. He was 18 years old when he died.
And the family did get some closure in the year 2000. There was some DNA evidence.
Mm-hmm. So, like they said, it's a very... It's kind of a long, drawn-out, bizarre story because he died so young, so soon after he got there, and then they held onto that hope for years that maybe he was still alive. And then in 1986, a Vietnamese bone smuggler found some bones and came into the U.S. trying to get citizenship. She wanted to trade them. Obviously, that's not how you get citizenship in the U.S., but they kept the bones. But the DNA technology at the time was not advanced enough to do anything with them, and so they were put on a shelf. And they stayed on that shelf until, I think, like 2000 or 2009, one of those two. And then they were tested. And then the family was finally notified in 2014 that it was Jim. Mm. And so he was buried on Veterans Day 2014 next to his father.
Wow. What a story. And then another story is that of Richard Bowers. Mm-hmm. What do we know about Richard?
So Richard is the brother of the woman that I knew growing up. And Richard grew up in Lake Mills. He was the second of five kids. And what really stood out to me with Richard's story as I was talking to his sister was that he was an extremely protective person. He was protective of all of his siblings growing up. He used to send his, he'd send his money back to his younger sister to save up a college fund. He went into the Army. And he was assigned to, he was kind of in an unusual position as he was an advisor, and he worked very closely with the South Vietnamese in kind of a little hamlet off by himself.
And he really enjoyed that.
Yes, he liked it a lot. He liked working with the South Vietnamese. He was very good friends also with the interpreter on his team. And he was, like I said, he was very protective, so he would write home to his family and say, you know, I'm up in the treetops watching the war go by. I'm not doing anything dangerous. But the truth was he was in a very dangerous position. He was part of the ambush teams that would go out at night. He was an enlisted man, and he finished his service, and he went home. But he was really worried about that hamlet and the interpreter especially, and he was also worried that one of his brothers might have to go overseas. And so he extended his tour of duty and went back over for another couple months.
Because if one brother was there, they wouldn't send another, is that
it? Yeah, that was kind of how it went. Not always, but a lot of the time that was how it went. And so he went back, and then he made it to the almost to the end of his tour. He had a job lined up back home. He had a car. And 10 days before his tour ended, they were ambushed. They were overrun. And it was kind of like with Jim's family. The family didn't know what happened to him for a long, long time. And they were another family that sat there in 1973 and watched and hoped that he would get off of the plane when the prisoners got off. And he didn't. And also, like Jim's family, they did eventually find out a lot of what happened, or what they think happened to Richard. And what they think happened was when the hamlet was overrun, he escaped, but then went back for another American who had been wounded. So there's that protective instinct that his sister has spoken about. And then they both made an escape attempt later in the day and were recaptured, and he was shot after they were recaptured. And then the other American who was there eventually died in captivity as well.
Wow.
Unlike Jim's family, they didn't recover Richard's body. So he's still missing in that sense.
We're talking with Erin Miller about her forthcoming book, Wisconsin's 37, The Lives of Those Missing in Action in the Vietnam War. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with author Erin Miller. Her forthcoming book from McFarland Press is Wisconsin's 37, The Lives of Those Missing in Action in the Vietnam War. There are two servicemen whose stories really overlap, and it's especially touching because of that. Tell us about Ray Haney and Tom Blackman.
Yeah, so Ray Haney and Tom Blackman, like you said, their stories really overlap, but they start off very differently. Tom grew up in Racine. He had many, many siblings, and he was an athlete. He was on his track team, and the people that I spoke to were very empathetic that he was not the star of his track team, but he was probably the hardest worker on that track team. And the school actually gives an award in his name now, and it's not given out every year. It's given out when the coach who knew Tom believes that somebody works hard enough to deserve it. So they really have honored his legacy. And he enlisted in the Marines around the same time that Ray enlisted a little bit earlier. So Ray grew up in a family where his parents died when he was very young, and he was raised primarily by his sisters. He grew up on a farm. He was a very quiet person. He really liked working the machines and riding his bike and those kind of things. And they both ended up in this Marine unit. And they departed from Hawaii, and they thought they were going to Japan. And about halfway through their trip there on the ship, they were told, no, you're going to South Vietnam. And so, you know, an unpleasant surprise for everybody there. So they end up getting to Vietnam, and their unit gets shifted around a little bit, and they end up at this little tiny outpost called Nak Ta Vak. And Nak Ta Vak is very much an isolated outpost. It's about the base itself is about the size of a football field. It's very overgrown. There's only about around 40, 45 Marines there. They're also stationed with some Australians, as well as some South Vietnamese and Chinese mercenaries as well. And the point of having this little outpost is there's a road that goes near the outpost, and it goes from Laos all the way up to a bigger base named Cam Duc. And the North Vietnamese want this road. And so the Australians have been guarding this road, and the Marines are there for support. And they have these two howitzer guns that are supposed to provide support. And now the veterans that I spoke to about this were emphasized that the machinery they had there was not the machinery that they needed to have, because they were on the top of this hill and these long-range guns weren't going to do anything in the case of an attack, which is what happened on May 10th, 1968. And so on that morning, there were about 500, 600 North Vietnamese attacked this base or this outpost. And it was very early, happened like 3 a.m. Tom actually had to wake somebody else up on base to say, you know, there's an attack, we need to get going. And it was very chaotic, and Ray was killed in the midst of this chaos. And Tom, there were some witnesses to Tom's death. Tom kind of approached the berm and left the protective area of this berm, and he fired for about 30 minutes and held that position before he was killed. Ray was 20, Tom was 19. Tom was awarded a Silver Star for, you know, the 30 minutes that led up to his death. But again, their story doesn't end either right there, because this Nak Ta Vak is overrun and the survivors have to leave. They have to leave this. And they gather the bodies in one place and put them where they can hopefully find them one day, and they leave. And then that outpost isn't touched for like 37 years. The North Vietnamese don't use it. They took the road and they went up to the Cam Duc, which is what their ultimate goal was. And back home in Wisconsin and across the entire country, the families were told a false story about what happened that day. They were told there was a search and rescue mission that had gone wrong and these men had gone missing during that. And so they held on to this hope, kind of like Jim's family, that maybe they're still alive. And the survivors, when they found out that that was the story that was being told, they made it their mission to correct that story and tell them what had really happened, because, you know, they couldn't bring them back, but they could at least say, you know, they are dead and this is how they died. And they went even further than that, though, because they were very insistent that they could find those bodies, that they could recover them. They started petitioning the VVAs and VFWs, and then eventually they went before a committee, a government committee, and said, you know, we can find these bodies. And they drew maps of the hill, and they made three separate trips out there. And on one of the trips, they actually met with the North Vietnamese that they fought that day. And walked through the battlefield because it had not been touched. They even found, they had these big trucks there, and they found an unexploded grenade on top of one of the trucks because it hadn't...
like frozen in
time. Yeah, it hadn't been touched at all. And so they were able to recover 11 men. 11 died at the battle, and then somebody else was lost during the escape, and they were able to recover the men who were lost at the battle.
We're talking with Erin Miller. She's the author of Wisconsin's 37, The Lives of Those Missing in Action in the Vietnam War. And Erin, I want to share something with our listeners who are not sitting in front of you like I am. You are telling these stories without looking at any notes. You're telling them like they are your story.
Yeah. I've spent 3.5 years with these men, and for a while, I had this huge whiteboard, and I would have their names on there of who was done, who wasn't done, and I became so familiar with those names. And over the last 3 years, speaking with the families and speaking with the veterans, it doesn't take a lot for me to talk about them. I feel like I don't know them. Obviously, they died 50 years ago, 45 years ago, but they're very individual to me. They're certainly not names on a list anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like talking about people that I know.
And one of the people, I'm guessing, that you feel perhaps that you know more than others is David Leet. Tell us about David.
Yeah, David was one of the first chapters that I wrote for this book. And for David, I was able to speak with two men who knew him overseas, as well as his sister. And David was a Marine. He grew up in Kenosha. The Leet family and the Van Bendegem family knew each other. I don't know if Dave and Jim knew each other or not. But he grew up in Kenosha, and he grew up on a farm. And Dave was a very, very playful person. I remember his sister showed me a picture of him and his high school senior picture, and he was kind of smiling, and she said, you can see how cheeky he was. and you really can. He has a very playful glint in his eye. He joined the Marine Corps because he wanted to fly. He went to UW, and he didn't attend the NROTC on campus. He attended Quantico down in Virginia back when it was the training center for the Marines. And he wanted to fly, and he went through all the training. He qualified to be a naval aviator, which is a really impressive achievement within the Marines. He got married. He had a very young son when he eventually went overseas. And Dave's job was to fly an electronic jamming plane. So he would go in before missions and he would jam the SAM sites, which is the surface-to-air missiles of the North Vietnamese, so that the people coming in after him wouldn't get hit. And he was flying one of those missions on April 13th, 1972, when he was shot down. And there's really not very much information about what happened. It happened at night. There was one other person on the mission, and he thought he saw an orange flare that might have been the plane. But him and the other man in the pilot in the plane, John Christensen, were never recovered.
And when you just said that date, you looked at something on your wrist. What is that?
I did. I have Dave's MIA bracelet. You know, thousands of these were made during the Vietnam War and given to for people who were missing in action, who might have been prisoners of war. And a lot of times families will send bracelets back as they're recovered, or when back in 1973 when they came home, they would send the bracelets back. And Dave's never been recovered. He is not coming home. But when I met with his sister had two bracelets and she gave me one. And so I've had Dave's name on my wrist for about 3 years. I think of him daily.
Wow. So, Erin, how did working on this project affect you?
A lot. I think one of the things I took the most out of it was just being courageous. That was kind of the trait that I took the most from it, and something that I remind myself frequently. Whenever I feel nervous about anything, I'm like, okay, take a step back here and remember that the men who were doing this were your age. Because when I started this, I was 21. And so some of them were, most of them were still a little bit older than me, but I'm 25 now, and most of them were, 18 to 26 years old. Yeah. So they were doing a lot more dangerous things at a very young age. And so I think about that. I also think about the importance of remembering people. It's hard for me to read military books anymore because a lot of names are just listed as a casualty, and I can't help but stop and read them and go, okay, but you had a family somewhere, and you have people who are probably still thinking about you. And just keeping those memories alive, I think that's extremely important.
Well, Erin, thank you so much for sharing these stories and spending the time with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
That was Erin Miller. Her forthcoming book from McFarland Press is Wisconsin's 37, The Lives of Those Missing in Action in the Vietnam War. First, for 150 years, Americans have observed Memorial Day. For some, it's a day off or time to spend with friends and family. For others, it's a day of remembrance for those lost in America's many wars and conflicts. The holiday as we know it today has its roots in the Civil War and has been observed in some way ever since. This year, it also falls on the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. Our next guest is here to talk about the history of Memorial Day and about how we've observed it over the years. Kenneth C. Davis is an author and historian. He's the author of Don't Know Much About History and other books in the Don't Know Much About series. His latest book, which he spoke with us about recently, is More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon, and it's a great pleasure to be with you on this very special American holiday.
It really is, and as we said in the intro, it's extra special because of these large commemorations, 150 years of the holiday, 100 years since the end of World War I. What are some of the earliest examples of observing Memorial Day?
Well, because we can argue about everything in America, we even argue about when Memorial Day began. I call it the 150th anniversary because this is the date on which a man named General John Logan, a Civil War and Mexican War veteran and a politician from Chicago, announced to a fraternal organization that they would set aside May 30th as a day on which to go and lay fresh flowers on the graves of the fallen, those who had fallen in the late Civil War. And that sort of officially marked as the beginning of Memorial Day, or as it was then known, Decoration Day, because people were going to decorate graves. There were several other earlier such ceremonies, including one in 1865 in Charleston, South Carolina. Petersburg, Virginia had one. So this is something that quite a few other cities and places have staked a claim to. But when we say this is the date, this is when we officially began marking May 30th, which used to be the day that most of the country marked Memorial Day or Decoration Day, except in the southern states. And that's another point we argue about, because they saw this as a Union holiday and they wanted to have their own Memorial Days for Confederate soldiers. So 150 years later, of course, we're still arguing about these memorials, monuments, and tributes to the men and women who were lost in the Civil War.
Well, it is very interesting, Ken, because as you said, this came out of the Civil War. Clearly, the North won, the South lost. And so it's understandable that the South would see this as almost, a gloating on the part of the North. So, but I'm sure that the South wanted to respect and honor their fallen soldiers as well. So did they have a parallel celebration, or did they try to distance themselves as much as possible?
No, there was actually it wasn't parallel. They set up separate days entirely, depending on which state. Some of them came on Robert E. Lee's birthday. Some were set on Jefferson Davis's birthday, Jefferson Davis being the president of the Confederacy. But it was very pointedly in opposition to this so-called Yankee or Union or Northern holiday. And when you go back and read what General John Logan wrote in May of 1868, 150 years ago, he said that this was to remember those to gather around the sacred remains of those who had fallen to bring freedom to a race in chains. Forgive me, I'm stumbling a moment. Freedom to a race in chains, and because they had fought a rebellious tyranny in arms. Well, that kind of sentiment did not certainly sit well in the defeated Confederacy, and that's why this holiday sprang up in other ways in the former Confederacy. Now, of course, as time went by and the Civil War was more or less forgotten, certainly by 50 years later, Memorial Day or Decoration Day had already become sort of a picnic holiday. People, in fact, used to take their picnic baskets and go to the cemeteries to lay those fresh flowers on the grave. So by the turn of the 20th century, Memorial Day had become, or Decoration Day had become, a sort of summer kickoff holiday in its own way. Then comes 1918 and the horrific losses 100 years ago at this time, as about a million American servicemen land in Europe to begin fighting in the war that was known as the Great War then, because there was no World War I, because they didn't know there would be a World War II.
I believe it was the war to end all wars, wasn't it?
That's what they called it afterwards, yeah. And that was certainly the optimistic hope when the guns fell silent and they negotiated the Versailles Peace Treaty in the spring of 1919. Of course, it resolved very little. There were predictions that another war would follow in 25 years. It only took 20 years from 1919, of course, to 1939 for Europe to go up in flames again. But it was the great losses by Americans, about 100,000 men lost in less than a year's time, that reawakened the much more unified desire to mark what Memorial Day should mean. And so it was expanded to become a holiday not to honor the Civil War dead, but all of those who gave their life in service to the country, what Abraham Lincoln had called in the Gettysburg Address, giving the last full measure of devotion. And that's what we mark today. I know people want to say Happy Memorial Day. I say it myself all the time. I stumble on it because it's not a happy day. It is a somber day of remembrance and celebration, I suppose, of this sacrifice. I suppose in one sense we could say we're happy that we have the freedoms that we have, but not acknowledge they came at enormous cost.
We're talking with Kenneth C. Davis. He's an author and historian, and he's sharing with us the history of Memorial Day and how it has changed over time. And Ken, so let's go back to that end of World War I, horrible, horrible conflict. Did the marking of Memorial Day or Decoration Day change after that tremendous loss that was so much more fresh and raw for people of the time than those losses of the Civil War?
It was clearly a bit of a turning point because the nation did come together and now acknowledge that we were a united nation that had lost and made tremendous sacrifices in Europe. And it was at that point that the decision was made in Congress to create a memorial in Arlington National Cemetery, of course, the tomb of the unknown soldier and the remains of a soldier who had been killed in the trench war in Europe were returned to the United States. That tomb was prepared and ready to be opened in 1921 on the Memorial Day or Decoration Day in 1921. So powerful symbolism about Memorial Day coming from the Civil War. Arlington itself, of course, is a vestige of the Civil War. It is built on land that was confiscated from the family of Robert E. Lee, the Virginia general who commanded the Army of Northern Virginia. It was deemed appropriate that the land that was confiscated from him should be turned into a cemetery for soldiers lost in that great conflict. World War I comes along, and we have two other very powerful symbols. One I just mentioned, the Tomb of the Unknown, comes out of World War I, but perhaps even more familiar to many people is the poppy, the symbol of remembrance, not only in America, but around the world. And this comes out of an incident in World War I in which a Canadian surgeon had gone to the terrible battlefield called Flanders. And he wrote a poem that begins very simply, "In Flanders fields the poppies blow between the crosses row by row." And that image of these blood-red poppies coming up in midst of this forest of crosses inspired a young American woman to start selling poppies, first silk poppies, later they became the paper poppies, as a way to raise funds for veterans of the war and their orphans and children. And that's how the poppy, a symbol of World War I, becomes associated with this holiday.
It's a very powerful symbol, and especially in Europe, when you're driving the roads in, especially northern Europe, you see poppies. Poppies are the most common roadside flower, and I think it is still so so present for people in Europe, the meaning of that flower in the context of World War I.
Very much the flower of remembrance, and as we've gone through these few years leading up to the centennial of the end of World War I, there have been these extraordinary displays of poppies in and around London in particular. Of course, for Americans, the war is a little bit remembered a little differently. August 1914 is the beginning of what became known as World War I. Was being fought for 3 years with such horrific losses of millions of men and women, civilians and soldiers, in the course of 3 years of fighting. The United States had remained neutral through all of that. Finally, in 1917, the United States decides to join the war in fighting Germany. And it then takes nearly a year, because we had no real standing army at the time. I think we had something like the 30th smallest army in the world at the time. President Wilson called for quickly ramping up the number of servicemen. And so these training camps sprang up across the country. And in the spring of 1918, we were ready to send 1 million men to France. And as we talked about the last time I was on the show, it was those million men who are carrying the virus, the Spanish flu virus, as it was later called, and brought it to France, that spread this terrible disease around the world. So you can't talk about the losses of World War I, in a sense, without discussing the terrible losses from the Spanish flu.
And it's so interesting, because the quantity and just huge number of losses in World War I is often attributed to the fact that it was really the first mechanized war. But then something as elemental as a virus has that tremendous toll as well.
That's right. I mean, we talk about round numbers, about 100,000 American soldiers dying in World War I, but maybe as many as 40,000 of those soldiers, if not more, died from the flu. War is always more deadly in the sense that diseases, infections, battlefield difficulties, contagions are usually much worse on the battlefield than the war itself. That was certainly true in the American Civil War and has been throughout history, and it proved to be true again in World War I. But even as you said, it was the first industrial war, in a sense. The munitions that had come online, the tanks, the gas, the artillery that could throw shells 75 miles. This was all brand new to a world that started World War I basically on horseback. And the men who took these countries into war had these almost romantic notions of battle on horseback, and pretty soon they were, of course, fighting along 400 miles of trenches where barbed wire and gas and tanks and machine guns changed the equation dreadfully.
We're talking with Kenneth C. Davis right now about the 150-year history of Memorial Day in the United States. He's an author and historian, including the Don't Know Much About History series. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. How do you observe Memorial Day? If you're a veteran, what are some memories you'd like to share? If you've lost someone to war, how do you remember them on this day? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we continue our conversation about the history of Memorial Day with Kenneth C. Davis. He's an author and historian. He's written numerous history books, including the Don't Know Much About History series. His latest book is More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What are some of your thoughts and remembrances on this Memorial Day? If you're a member of the military, what do you wish people understood about Memorial Day? And if you have memories of family members serving, please call in now. The number again, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to the phones, and Carol in Milwaukee is up first. Hi, Carol.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I wanted to say I'm a pacifist, and I don't believe in war in general, and I don't even believe in the Second World War. Certain wars they think are good, and people say, well, we had to defeat Hitler, but I believe we should work way ahead of time and try to solve things that cause war instead of waiting until a Hitler or a Trump show up and then say, well, we have to have war now, because Trump loves war and Hitler, you know, believed in war, I think. So I believe what we should do is first try to make friends around the world, try to help other countries so that they don't want to have war against us. And instead of going around the world having war against countries like the Middle East, we've been there for almost 17 years. What in the world are we doing there for that long?
And Carol, I just want to follow up and make sure that that Ken has a chance to respond. But I wanted to ask you, as a pacifist, how do you then treat the people who are sent to war, whether they choose to go or not, who either die on the battlefield or as a result of battle or come home as veterans? How do you, as a pacifist, relate to them?
Out. I believe that churches should tell their young people not to go to war before it's too late, before they get PTSD. I believe we should be warned about what war is before going, instead of encouraging them by giving them honors when they go to war, when they get, you know, a Purple Heart or whatever. This is all causing more children to think it's so cool to go to war.
All right. Thanks for that call, Carol. And Ken, would you like to respond?
Oh, my goodness. There's so much to dig into there. Immediately, I think, for instance, of Dr. King and how he probably would have been very much inclined to agree with the caller, and I thank her for the call. On the other hand, we're talking about a holiday born out of the Civil War, which was the result of a long process of the inability to compromise on the idea that people could be kept in chains. Was there any other alternative ultimately to ending slavery in America without armed conflict? I wish it had been the case. It proved not to be. So clearly there are sometimes things that we must finally take a stand against. I would probably be more inclined to agree with the caller than not about how we can, you know, we should be working a lot harder to prevent such conflicts. And most of the wars in history have been grossly unnecessary, including World War I. But what do you do when there is no compromise on an issue as fundamental as the enslavement of 4 million people? They're very difficult questions.
Thanks again for that call, Carol. Let's go back to the phones, and Chuck is in the Village of Eagle. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
Just wanted to comment on Memorial Day is that it is many things. It's turned commercial, and it's a time for reflection. It's not a time for mattress sales. It's not a time for car sales. And one thing that really irritates me, I'm a veteran, but not a combat veteran, but a lot of combat veterans I know, is wishing somebody a happy Memorial Day. There's nothing happy about it. I had a good friend who fought in Fallujah. He's no longer with us, but every Memorial Day, he was sad and he kind of withdrew. He just couldn't believe people would go around with that happy attitude. And that's all I have to say, really.
Well, and Chuck, I'd like to follow up on that. I've also seen posted from NPR today that some veterans also say that they would prefer that people not say thank you for your service. Is there something more meaningful, a way to mark the holiday and what it represents, that rings true for someone like you who has served and has lost fellow friends that have served?
Well, I think many communities still have their veteran services over at a cemetery or at a VFW hall. But if you look at the participation and the number of people that show up for that somber remembrance, it's very few, maybe a handful. It's still more about the hype and the fun and games, I guess I'll call it. But, you know, it's a little cliche to say thank you for your service. I'm finding it gets a little old after a while. It's sort of like the grocery checker saying thank you and have a good day. It just becomes so methodical and mechanical, it's lost its meaning.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for that call, Chuck. And Ken, would you like to reflect on that?
I think I completely understand what the caller is expressing. I think we even referred to it when we opened the interview here, that it isn't a day to say happy Memorial Day. The best case I can make is that we acknowledge that we are allowed the freedom to be happy on this weekend and do things like the beach and the barbecue because of enormous sacrifice over more than two centuries now. So I think that, you know, we've come a long way in recognizing what this holiday is, but certainly it is grotesquely commercialized. I saw one promotion today that it's National Hamburger Day and you should be patriotic by barbecuing. I mean, those sentiments are, to me, the worst kind of recognition of what this day is. Look, Congress asks us to do something very simple today, 30 seconds of silence, just a moment of silence. I always recommend people that they actually take 2 minutes to read Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. Read what Lincoln said when he dedicated the cemetery at Gettysburg in November of 1863 and spoke two tweets worth of words that are timeless. And
we'll have to leave it there. Ken, thank you so much for joining us today. Kenneth C. Davis is an author and historian. He's the author of Don't Know Much About History and other books in the Don't Know Much About series. His latest book is More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. He joined us to talk about the history of Memorial Day. with the hot weather we've been having here in Wisconsin. A lot of us don't want to heat up the kitchen if we can avoid it, so we've been firing up the grills. And that got me thinking about the new Impossible Burgers and Beyond Burgers, which are new plant-based patties that really try to mimic the experience of eating a real beef burger. Of course, veggie burgers and sausages are nothing new, but the previous ones would probably never be mistaken for the real thing. But this new generation can be, at least by some, and that's their goal. In fact, the Impossible Burger uses the soy equivalent of hemoglobin. You know, the ingredient in meat that gives it the red color when raw and that slightly metallic taste. And if you don't overcook those burgers, the Impossible Burger even, quote, bleeds juice that looks like a beef burger. So we want to hear from you. If you're vegetarian, could you enjoy that? Or is that experience a little too close to feeling like you're actually eating meat? And if you're not a vegetarian, would you try these new non-meat burgers for either health or maybe environmental reasons? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know what you think. If you've tasted one, definitely let us know how you liked it. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org with your thoughts. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. And then we'll learn about what benefits the Hmong American Service Recognition Act provides for those veterans. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.